Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, January 28th. I'm Ray Graff. It's cold outside and getting colder. Wind chills should hover around 15 below tonight. It'll be very cold the next several days. We are now in the middle, smack dab in the middle, as Joe Williams used to sing, of winter. This is a good time to think spring, and we welcome back Greg Ward and Fred Breglia for a gardening show. Love these midwinter gardening shows. They're always fun, full of optimism. You got a gardening question, indoor or outdoor, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Fred, Greg, your gardening call's coming up right after the news. Hi, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us to answer your gardening questions today, Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery and arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. If you have a gardening question, give us a call right now, 800-348-2551. If experience tells me anything, it's that these midwinter gardening shows can be very popular. So there are a few open lines now. Get in if you want to get in. 800-348-2551 is the number. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. That's voxpop@wamc.org. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum. Fred, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back, right? How you been?
How you doing, man? How's winter treating you?
You know, I've been doing good. The Arboretum is actually quite busy. We have, it's a winter wonderland out here. We have an incredible amount of snow. It's been really great snow, and there's been a lot of people coming out. In fact, there was about 20 cars today that I counted in the parking lot, and all people with snowshoes. So it's like little snowshoe highways through all our trails, and it's a winter wonderland, so people can come on out, and there's no charge to come. But donations are always accepted.
Well, very cool. And that is, of course, in Esperance, New York. Greg Ward runs Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Greg, how has the winter been treating you?
Very well. We just finally started getting some snow after that first big one that melted off in December. So I'm getting pretty happy. I think I can do a little cross-country skiing in South County now.
Oh, cool. Well, that's great.
All right.
You know, Greg, you might be able to answer this one better than Fred, although Fred seems to know a lot about everything. So I'll throw it to you first, Greg. And I was thinking about this over the weekend. I was in the hardware store, big box hardware store, and I saw that they had grow lights. And I got thinking about grow lights and the spectrum. And I said, you know what, I'm going to ask these guys today. And lo and behold, at about noon today, Lou and Altamont asked a question about grow lights. So I will read his question and we'll get going here. Lou writes, when starting plants inside under grow lights, can plants be given too much light? If the moisture and feed requirements are met, do plants require some darkness? Also, any way I can test my bulbs to tell if the spectrum is still useful for plant growth?
Wow, that's pretty cool. So, you know, basically grow lights are these days are usually considered full spectrum, so they cover the whole gamut. The red light is the ideal light if you're limited, so even incandescence and fluorescence will work for growing seedlings. And generally, there's not a concern with too much light, though you know an extended day is usually recommended if you're only using light. So no more than 8 hours, a 10, 12, 15-hour day, if that's all you have for light. You know, I think we talk sometimes in the fall about poinsettias and getting them to bloom, and they do control the amount, the day length when they're trying to do that. But for seed starting, it's really not a concern.
Okay, Fred, do you want to chime in there?
Yeah, I would just say that if they're using like your classic like grow tubes, which are like your fluorescent lights, which are most commonly used probably by homeowners to start seeds and things, you really want to keep the amount of light dissipates very rapidly as you bring the light away from a seedling. So you want to keep those lights very low to the plants, really close to the plants. And as they grow, you raise the light. And, you know, some darkness in there, especially depending on what you're doing, is going to be needed. The plant wants a rest at some point. But keeping them close to the plants is key, especially on those those classic grow tube fluorescent lights that a lot of homeowners use. You really can't get them too close. You just don't want them to touch.
Greg Ward is here from Ward's Nursery. Fred Breglia is here from Landis Arboretum. Another question about grow lights came in just before we started, and this one's from Edward in the 518. Edward says, I'm on my first year of hydroponics. Full spectrum LED, 4 foot length times 8, 2 inch PVC pipe with plants at 16 inches set up in a circle with a circulation pump. My plants are turning yellow even after adding organic plant food, nitrogen, and magnesium. Are the lights too far away? Presently about a foot away from the base of the plants. Plants are about a foot and a half high. Spinach is the majority of my crop. And that is from Edward.
I'm glad you mentioned LED lights, because a lot of the all of the new bulbs, as we know, are going LED. And still, as Fred said, you want to keep them close, because neither fluorescence nor the LED lights heat up too much. If you're still using, I'm tangenting, but if you're still using incandescent bulbs, you got to be careful. They can get really hot and can even be a little dangerous to the plants. Spinach is notorious for having potential iron deficiencies. So that's my first thought. It does depend on the yellow that he's seeing. If it's a sort of a even, sort of pale color all the way around, it could be low light, but more likely it's a nutrient deficiency of some kind. Maybe his water pH is a little high, and that is acting as a limiting agent for the uptake of iron.
Fred.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's, probably not a yellowing from a light. It would take a significant amount of light to start to see that kind of symptom. So it would be probably most likely a nutrient deficiency. And since he is adding, he said, nitrogen, it's, which is most commonly the one that you see associated with yellowing, probably going to be more of a micronutrient in this case. And it very well may be locked up due to pH. We don't have all the information to be able to make the exact call on this one, because we just don't know what the pH is, and we don't know his regular feeding schedule and stuff. But complete fertilizers, including micronutrients, are going to be what we generally recommend, because although in soil it's very rare to see a deficiency of a micronutrient, it's a lot more common to see a micronutrient deficiency very easily in containerized plants. And in hydroponic systems, where water is your main source, I would tend to check that pH of that water first and move forward from there.
All right. Now, a couple of outdoor questions that came in via email well before the show started, and then we'll take a quick break, and then we'll hit the phones. The number is 800-348-2551. Gardening Today with Fred Breglia and Greg Ward. This is from Carrie in Durham, New York. I have wild black cap raspberries growing along the edges of my pastures. Last summer, I noticed that they were getting overgrown with Virginia creeper and wild roses. I cleared out around them to give them more light. When should I prune them? And should I even bother this year, or just see how they do with more room and light? And that's from Carrie.
Yeah, want me to do it?
Sure.
Basically, the blackberries, raspberries, they're doing the same thing. They're for the most part, blooming on second-year wood. So the shoots that came up this summer, with some exception, we can get into that in a minute with raspberries, but with blackberries, the shoots that came up this summer are going to survive the winter and then flower in the spring and fruit in the summertime. And the shoots that were fruiting last summer are now no longer viable and will not sprout this spring. They're just dead wood. So you can go in and remove all the old ones. And sometimes you go, well, how can I tell? There's often a significantly different color. The new ones tend to be greener or redder. The old ones will tend to be brown. And usually by now, they're looking kind of dead even. So by color, you can kind of go through and sort them out and prune out all the dead ones. You can shorten the newer ones, the first year ones, like by tipping them a little bit, and we sometimes recommend that to kind of create more branching so you get more flowering. And so if they feel comfortable doing any of that, I think that this is a great time to do it, especially if you're not too close to Fred with all that snow.
All right. This one's from Joe in Eagle Mills. And Joe is a regular call screener for this program, but he's not here today. And Joe writes, it would not be a gardening show without the perennial favorite about pruning lilacs, right? We have a lilac bush outside a window, which was only supposed to grow 4 feet tall. Right now, it's over 12 feet and apparently climbing. When should we cut it back, and how much at a time should we cut it back? Fred Breglia.
All right. Well, with the lilacs, the general rule is you want to prune them pretty much immediately after they get done blooming. So, you know, you wait till they bloom out and then start to – the plant's going to start to put resources for next year's seeds. And it's also going to start to build up flower buds for the following year right after they bloom. So if you take off the deadheads and start to do any pruning right after they bloom, you're going to get the maximum blooms for the following year. And generally, you know, one-third is the maximum that we would recommend taking off or away. And, you know, you could certainly shorten that plant and keep it kind of lower by doing what we call reduction cuts, cutting back the laterals. But you also could and should take out about maybe one-third or quarter of the oldest, thickest, fattest canes. And often those are the ones that are growing up and probably creating a problem in terms of the height discrepancy that he wants there. So sometimes just removing one-third of the oldest, thickest canes, getting them out right close to the ground, you might actually have a shrub that now looks a lot closer to what you want. And then you could do a little reduction cut off of there and kind of keep that up either annually or even, you know, maybe once every 2 years, depending on how much growth you're getting. And he should be in good shape.
All right, we have to take a quick break here, and then we will go to the phones. Greg Ward is here from Ward's Nursery. Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum. The number is 800-348-2551, and we'll be right back. Fox Pop, Gardening Today with Fred Breglia and Greg Ward. Ray Graff here. The number is 800-348-2551 if you want to call in. And let's go to the phones. Ryan in Malta. Ryan, you're on.
Hi, gents. I had to tear apart some daffodils. Daffodils. The seeds or the bulbs were actually impacted. I didn't get them all planted. So come spring, or even if we have the regular winter thaw, should I put them in or should I start them inside? Is it better to start them inside somehow?
Let me do it.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So you have some bulbs that you took out of the ground or out of a pot and now, right? And they're in a bag somewhere.
Right.
Right, bare root bulbs. Yeah, so you definitely want to get them planted. And as you said, you know, it's kind of impossible to do it now unless we get a big thaw all of a sudden. So by potting them up, finding some, you know, some 1 or 3 gallon pots and putting them halfway down and filling them full of even garden soil or you know, topsoil. You can certainly use potting soil at this point. And then putting them in some cool place, watering them really well so they're well saturated, and then putting them in some cool place where they don't really freeze, but they stay fairly cold. I think I've mentioned before that bottom step of the outside cellar access, you know, your bulkhead, you walk down the stairs and there's another door. That bottom step is probably going to stay in the, 32, 35 degree range when it's really cold, and that would be just right, or anything similar to that. So not too warm, not really frozen solid, and they will begin to root now, and that's what you want. And then you could let them come up, and you could even transplant them in April into the garden.
Wow. Okay, thank you.
Ryan, thank you. The number is 800-348-2551. Gardening Today on Vox Pop. Maureen is in Newburgh. Maureen. Hi, Maureen. Hi, how are you? You're on.
Oh, good. Hi. So a bag of potting soil I used this summer, and then, like, it was half used, and it had all these little fly things in it. And, of course, I used them for some indoor plants. So I have these little, like, fruit flies. Not many, but enough to be bothersome. What's the story? I've never had that happen.
Yeah, it could be, depending on how small. Are they really, really, really small? Like, because it could be fungus gnats if the potting soil got wet. and it stayed kind of moist for a while. Fungus gnats are kind of like these little tiny flies, but they look, I guess, kind of like a fruit fly, but they would even be smaller than a fruit fly.
Yeah, I think I'd say that.
Agree. They're
true.
They're definitely fungus gnats.
Go ahead.
I would say there's no question. They're a fungus gnat.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do I do?
And, you know, you can get rid of them. There is a Bacillus thuringiensis. It's actually a type of a bacteria that you could do as a drench to the soil, and I know that would take out a lot of the fungus gnats. Should be fairly easy to get that. Greg probably even has that available in his shop over there. But I think it was called Natrol is the product I used to use, Natrol, which is a bacteria.
You can do that. It's what you're doing there is killing the little larvae. So in the soil, feeding on the fungus that's breaking down that nice organic matter, because you've got some nice organic potting soil, and that they do tend to be a good place for fungus gnats when the bag is left open and it's gotten wet, sometimes even in your house, but usually from being outside. And so what we usually recommend is don't keep the plant too wet by letting it get, you know, you don't want to stress the plant, but by letting it get slightly dry, that root ball, you do reduce the ability for those fungus gnats to succeed and become adults, which is what's flying around your house. So number one, keep them on the dry side. Number two, we actually recommend those, which are you can get most any garden store, those yellow sticky cards. These are things that it's like flypaper, but it's made for catching insects in greenhouses to identify what you might have flying around out there. So by putting a couple of yellow sticky cards in some of the pots of your plants, or especially the pot you did, then you'll catch those flying guys, and that might just take care of the whole thing. That might get enough of them out of the air that you won't mind seeing one or two once in a while.
So the bag that's outside, if it freezes, is that going to help kill these for the next year, or do I?
I would recommend using the bag in the future for outdoor plants.
Sounds great. Thanks.
It sometimes can be a pain to get rid of them indoors. Outdoors, it's pretty easy.
Fred, your connection is not the best at this. You sound vaguely like Eisenhower when he was doing the World War II D-Day announcements. So you're fading in and out, but we'll hope for the best here. I don't know. Maybe
I do have another line if you want to try to call me on a different line. I have another line here available. The usual line, the phone company had an issue with this morning, but they got it ready for me before the show, so it worked out. Do you want me to give you that regular office number?
Maybe. Zach the engineer, yay or nay? Give me a thumbs up. He's giving me two thumbs up, so apparently we'll give that a shot. We'll work that one out, and in the meantime, we will go to our friend Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on.
Hello, gentlemen, and I do hope that we can get Fred back, because I believe my question is right up his alley.
I think he's still here. Fred, are you there?
Good.
I'm still here. Yeah, I'm hanging on.
Okay, well, here comes Joan.
Okay.
I would like to identify natives, indigenous woodland species for a shade garden I'm growing. I've got, you know, most of the usual guys, the pachysandra, the myrtle, creeping myrtle. I'm looking for stuff that can be responsibly harvested with landowner permission, and which stuff to stay away from. Just leave it in place if it's there. Any advice?
Are you looking for, you're looking to be able to eat some native material as well? You're saying plant it more of a permaculture way in the forest and actually be able to harvest things and actually utilize materials. Is that correct? Or am I coming through clear?
Yeah, the main thing I want to do is a ground cover up to a small shrub space where, you know, there's part of the yard that's just so shady, it too often goes to dirt instead of growth.
I'm just looking for vinca to do well in
rich soil.
Yeah, vinca is a good ground cover. So if you're looking for a ground cover that's kind of tolerant of shade and tough soils, vinca minor would be a good ground cover. That would certainly work. If you're looking for native vine.
Okay, now I think of that. Is that the creeping myrtle?
You know, it's not actually the creeping myrtle. It's a different, that's a different plant.
Okay.
It's you often will see that in a lot of landscapes. There's a bunch of native, like if you're just looking for a general ground cover or even a vine, I personally like Virginia creeper.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some people, it's not going to be anything that you would harvest, but it would work well. If you're looking for more ephemeral type of plants in a woodland setting, and often in a woodland setting you can get away with these other ephemeral than they're natives, things like the Allium trichocum, which is a ramp. It's also called wild leek. They will form huge patches in the ground and cover that entire area over, but they're only around for some part of the year because they complete their life cycle very quickly. But the taste of the ramps, the wild ramps, are just, you know, as long as you're sustainably harvesting them, they could take that for years, you know. And I've had patches where I've been harvesting those for years and years and years, and I've watched the patch get larger and larger over time. And a lot of times you can find them actually at your local, once the spring hits, you should see them at, like, farmers markets. And a lot of times, like, when I harvest them, I tend to cut them above the root. So I leave the root, which is actually going to be helping the patch. But a lot of times you'll see them at farmers markets, and they have them roots and all, and really, really green, the green. And you can literally plant them. They take really well to transplanting. It does take a while to spread that out. But if you were looking for a ground cover that was edible and it's native, it would be a little hard to establish. But, you know, if you put a little time in and you have the right condition, it will take right over.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call.
I've had good luck with that. We could go for a while with this one, but thank you very much. And if you have more questions, you can follow up on my email, fred@landisarboretum.org.
fred@landisarboretum.org. And while we're at it, Greg Ward, what's your email address?
Oh, yes. So we have info@wardsnursery is a great one. Certainly, the fellow with the spinach, if he sent us some photos, I might be able to help him determine if it's a...
Okay, and that's a .com?
Info@wardsnursery.com. Yeah.
Okey-doke.
And a couple of, you know, I just want to mention a couple of really fun native shade-tolerant ground covers, Pennsylvania sedge and hay-scented fern, two plants that, you know, are living around here pretty well and would do well as a shady ground cover.
Okay. I like the creeping myrtle thing. That's, you know, I think I went out with her in the 80s for a couple of times, and she was something of a stalker, so we let it go. Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, Greg, I got a question for you. Where can I get green tea leaves and banana leaves?
Grocery store.
Banana leaves are probably a little tricky. Certainly, you know, some of the Asian markets probably for those, possibly, you know, because to get them fresh, I'm not sure. Green tea, I'm not a tea drinker, although I am having a little mint tea right now, but I would suggest the supermarket or any market for green tea.
Sure.
Yeah.
What are you going to do, Chris?
No, green tea leaves.
I'm sorry?
Green tea leaves.
Green tea leaves.
Green tea leaves.
I see.
Yeah.
Green tea leaves?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you go, are you looking for more like the, so if you're looking for like the actual, like, so it's not powdered up, you mean, you wanted it more like a whole leaf?
Yes.
If you wanted more whole leaf, you'd have to probably go to like a health food store. An organic type market would certainly have it. If you went to like any of the organic markets, I would have to think you would have no problem finding that there. But the whole leaf green tea, which I am a tea drinker, the whole leaf green tea is not as easy to find in like the classic supermarket.
Okay. Well, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number if you have a gardening-ish question. Let's go to Doug in Kingston. Doug, you're on.
Good afternoon. My question today has to do with commercial mulch, and I'm looking for another alternative or option because commercial mulch seems to have a fake color to it. It breaks down quickly. The roots grow through the landscape material underneath. So I was wondering if you had a different concept or suggestion to keep the weeds at bay.
Yeah, I'll take that one if you don't mind. I just came back, or I shouldn't and didn't actually go anywhere, but I just attended the virtual ISA conference, International Society of Arboriculture virtual conference this year, and it just past, but they had a whole bunch of new research on mulch and a bunch of studies, and it was some interesting stuff. They ultimately, you know, weed fabric is really not a good thing for plants. It does have a purpose for smothering things, and if you're going to use them under like driveways or stonework, it can work well. But the weed fabrics around plants have been shown through research to cause a bunch of different problems that are not good for the microbes and the plants and the root systems and respiration. So then they did a bunch of studies on various types of mulches around trees, including bare earth and turf grass. And the ultimate, the quick answer on all this is that it still looks like, you know, a classic organic bark mulch or even a wood chip, not a fine wood chip where you have potential for like little sawdust to get into the profile, but like an actual wood chip. They tend to see the best results overall. No weed fabric, about 2 to 2.5 inches of absolute maximum mulch, and you're going to have the best overall result in plant health. And you start to get too much mulch, then you cut down the air exchange, and that's what's kind of going on here. You got an air exchange between the roots and the above ground part of the environment, and the air needs to go in and it needs to come out. So you start to get over 2.5, 3, 4 inches, it starts to cut down that airflow. So there's an actual recommendation where, you know, you don't just add every year 2 inches of mulch. You actually go out and look at the situation and say, okay, well, you know, it has like 2 inches of mulch here, so maybe you're only adding 1/4 inch this year. And there might be some years where you need to take it away, but you want to maintain about a 2.5 inch mulch barrier out as far as you can to the drip line of your plants or beyond. But that seems to be the best result. Now, yep. In terms of getting those mulches, you know, you're not looking for the palletized mulches and the ones that are shredded and all these fancy dyes. The true organic mulches, you know, if you got like a hemlock mulch, it would be red. But otherwise, it's going to be brown, and it's going to be a natural color, and you don't need to worry about it ever fading away. It's not dyed. No additions.
Yeah, I agree. So that the weed fabric, what happens is you put it down, you think you have everything set, no weeds are going to come through it, and that's true. But the mulch, regardless of which one you use, and some obviously break down faster, will eventually create a soil-like material on top of that fabric, and now the seeds that blow in can root on that and root through the fabric. So now you're really fighting the whole situation. So not using the weed fabric around your plants is really highly recommended. And as Fred said, under a walkway when you're going to put some bricks down or a patio of some kind, that's probably the better place to use it. Sometimes the drip line up against your house, if you're going to have a separate material, maybe a crushed stone or something, it can work well there. Those yep. colored mulches are dyed. They're taking yep. wood chips from pretty much anywhere, and they're dyeing them. And so you don't really know what you have. It's really, you know, it really is much better, as again, Fred mentioned, hemlock or pine or a northern hardwood bulk, you know, mulch, to kind of know where it's coming from. And that's all. That's all right. My 2 cents.
Well, Doug, thanks for the call. It's Gardening Today with Fred Breglia and Greg Ward. The number is 800-348-2551. And John is in Cooperstown. Hello, John. Hello.
Another lilac question.
Okay.
I dug up a volunteer from an older lilac bush in. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound yep. like you're at the bottom of a well, but go ahead.
Okay. Oh, is that any better?
Oh my God! Yes. Yeah, that's wow. much better.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. It's a lilac question. I dug up a volunteer from an old, very old lilac bush. Now I've got it in a pot that's just with dirt from the out of the garden. Should that stay outside in a unheated garage, or should it actually be in the basement for the winter?
You know, when did you pot it up, in the fall?
Yes, in the fall.
Yeah, so it's just been sitting in a container right now. Is it inside with leaves on it, or is it like has it gone to sleep? Has it gone to dormancy?
It's dormant. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. Generally, you know, when we dig those up in the fall, you actually could dig them up and put them either in a container and hold them in the ground for a while. But if you just planted it right in the ground, that would have also worked. So now we want to keep it dormant, and you want to insulate the container from freezing temperatures. So, you know, putting it outside where the container would just, the root systems would freeze. That's what you're worried about. At this point, you might be better off in the kind of like what Greg had said about the first step of the basement there, kind of keeping it in that 32-degree range, 35-degree range, just keeping it dormant until you get a chance. If there's a thaw out there where you can get a chance to work the soil, I would put it right in. Otherwise, as soon as you can get it in the ground in the spring, put it in, and you should have luck. They do transplant really well. So I've had great luck with lilacs with even just a little bit of root. They can take a beating, and they really do. It's a great plant.
Greg.
Yeah, just briefly, the if the basement is cold, if it's literally nice and chilly down there, maybe you have a separate room from the furnace or something, then it could probably work out in there just fine, like a root cellar. But that unheated garage is almost like a root cellar, and yeah. I think Fred would agree that it's probably, you know, it's not going to lose any moisture because there's no air moving in there, that if you water it well and slide it in the corner in the dark spot of that unheated garage, that's probably going to be just fine.
All right, let's
If you did have any, if you had any sort of like mulch material or a couple of bags of potting soil or a couple of bags of mulch that you didn't even have to open, you can kind of put it around something, a little insulation around that, just in case the temperature, if he's putting it in something where the temperature could drop too cold, maybe that would help as well.
All right, fellas, we'll take a quick break here. The number is 800-348-2551. Then we'll open the email bag, and then we'll get back to the phones. Fred Breglia, Greg Ward here, and we'll be back. Fox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. The Gardening Show today in the middle of the winter already. Greg Ward and Fred Breglia here to answer your questions. And I tell you what, guys, a little, I will farm these questions out to each of you so we can get through as many as possible, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one looks like a good one for Greg. This one's from Kate in Goshen, New York. I have spots in my garden where the plants don't seem to thrive or produce well. Over the last 5 years, I have thrown down a few bags of cow manure and some chicken manure and a very nice aged compost. I also pay attention to which plants get along with the others and keep that in mind when planting. Should I be treating the soil? Could it be the seeds? I always buy organic seeds or start with seedlings. Thanks for your help. And that's from Kate in Goshen, New York.
Well, it sounds like Kate is talking about maybe her vegetable garden, possibly annual. She's planting seeds, so I'll stick with vegetables. You know, starting vegetables from seed directly in the ground can work really well, or it can fail, and it has a lot to do with what kind of moisture we're getting when, you know, and what the temperatures are when you do all that. So usually a nice even rain is right after you seed is probably the best way to have success. You know, some years my carrots do great and other years they do not. If it's about a specific spot in the garden, which I guess she also mentioned, that's a little trickier. And if she's worked, it sounds like she's worked in more than enough organic matter. So now I would, you know, just consider exposure and moisture at this point. You know, in the event that the garden has is sort of an old sort of area where people dump some other things, there may be some pH or other nutrient issues that are limiting the soil. But most likely, it's about moisture and exposure.
Now, this one is perfect for Fred. This is from Chris in Cornwall on Hudson. We have a newly cleared area in our woods and would like to plant some evergreens, specifically blue spruce there. However, there are two big black walnut trees growing there, and I've heard you can't plant near them. Is that the case, and which species of evergreen would be best in our thick clay and rocky soil? And that's from Chris in Cornwall on Hudson.
All right. Well, actually, that's a great question, and actually it brings up a couple of cool things. So first off, the whole black walnut thing I'll address, because this one's been going on for a long time, and it, again, you know, recent research has actually showed that this is going to be proved not correct. So the big thing with the black walnuts out there, and if you search online, you'll see this as well, that there's an allelopathic type of toxin that's released out of the black walnut root system, and it kind of kills things underneath the root systems of these black walnut trees. And there, if you go online, there's like a handful of different varieties that seem to work better under those black walnut trees or not. And the truth of that is that actually has been proven to be a myth. In a nursery setting where you would have a black walnut in a container and you put little seedlings in, there would be enough allelopathic poison that would come out and actually kill the seedling. So in that sense, it's true. It's not a myth. But when you have an actual outdoor setting under a large black walnut, and then you have a bunch of these mysterious plants keep dying on you, you know, it tends to be sort of breeds that same thing that happened in the nursery trials to life. And reality is, black walnuts are guzzlers of water. And it's been proven now through research that actually the main reason why plants are dying under black walnuts are because the black walnuts are guzzlers of water, and they'll out-compete your other plants that you put under them. And only a handful of plants can tolerate the drought that you're going to see underneath a black walnut. So if you actually watered the plants that you put under the black walnut, you could have probably a lot of plants growing quite well under your black walnut tree. That being said, the guy's question was about evergreens, and he wants blue spruce. Unfortunately, blue spruce, nothing to do with the walnut. It is an issue because it has a needle cast fungus disease, which has been really threatening blue spruce dramatically through the landscapes and anywhere they're planted. So
yeah.
So nowadays, we don't recommend planting blue spruce any longer, at least at this point, because you'll be fighting a needle cast disease. But a Norway spruce right now is probably one of the most carefree spruce. There's still some issues with, you know, virtually all plants, but this one's going to tolerate the clay soils pretty well, and has the least problems in terms of a lot of the spruce that we see around here. If you could get away with some pines in there, too, that would be nice to mix it up. We always say, you know, kind of 5% mass if you're going to plant a bunch of stuff. Don't put a bunch of the same species in there. Mix it up with some different genuses so that if you had a problem, just like the needle cast on the blue spruce, it doesn't go through and take everything out. So I'd say Norway spruce, think about maybe some other, maybe white pine if you can get away with it. A very adaptable plant, and in terms of the black walnut, if you're planting under a black walnut, make sure you're willing to water whatever's under that black walnut. The walnut will drink more water than most of your plants, but that allelopathic condition that plagues a lot of people, and we've been hearing this, and in fact I've heard this studied even in college, has been proven to be true, but only in nursery trials in actual containers, and not so much in the wild.
Okay.
It's more of a water issue.
All right, well, you've both had a question, Fred Breglia and Greg Ward. This will be a free-for-all. Please feel free to buzz in. This is from Josh. Can I water my outdoor plants with hot tub water? I drain 500 gallons a month and would like not to have it go to waste. Please prove my wife wrong. That's from Josh. Go.
Well, as long as there's no chlorine in there, for sure.
But I think there would be a lot of chlorine in a hot tub. I don't have a hot tub here, but wouldn't there be enough like chemicals in that water to disrupt that? Or
Fred, I do not have a hot tub either. I have no idea what to do with them.
Okay.
I have been in a couple hot tubs, but I don't ever remember them being chloriney.
Okay.
So
what?
I assume as long as they're not adding things, that water is definitely, that's nice gray water that would be great for the garden.
All right, fair enough. We'll take that as an answer. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Roger in New Lebanon. Roger, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I have the hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure. Hi.
Yes.
Okay.
I have the honor and privilege of taking care of the Lady of Lords shrine at the Immaculate Conception Church. And in front of the shrine, the grass has a lot of weeds in it. Can I tackle this weed? Chemicals are not an option in front of the shrine, but can I do it with some limestone? Would you suggest a double hydrate or a regular or a pelletized? And what would be the timing of it, and should I have the mower guy skip one of the mowings to let the grass overtake the weeds?
Okay. Who wants this one?
Well,
Greg?
it's always interesting, and it's usually not a 1 week project in terms of having it solved. If you have a lot of weeds in the area that you don't want to treat it with herbicides, then you can physically remove them. So one thing you could consider is taking a sod cutter and going around all the places, areas that you don't want, and then laying some sod. That's expensive, but will look instantaneous, and you'll have just grass because that's how sod comes. The second option would be to literally dig up the area, as I suggested, but in this case, just pulling all the weeds out, rake out that soil, and add a grass seed to those areas. So you're just, and some organic matter to make that soil more conducive. Usually, weeds are showing up in the lawn for a couple of reasons. I'm channeling Bob now, but water, an inch of water a week is really important, and that will help soil compaction. So there's a lot of traffic around that area. That's going to promote weed growth. And then poor nutrition. So adding, compost or organic matter to the existing soil will increase that nutrient value.
All right, Roger, thank you very much. We go now to Sally in Saugerties. Hello, Sally.
Shelley.
Well, okay. Hello. It says Sally, but you're on.
Yes.
Hi, Shelley.
Hi. So before Christmas, I bought a Lenten rose, a heliobore. Yeah. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
And it bloomed, and it was a lovely flowering plant. And now most of that is dead, is gone. But the plant still has green, and it has little... It's starting to grow more from the base.
Fantastic.
And I was wondering, oh, goody. So what do I do with it?
You keep doing what you're doing. Don't ignore it. Don't overwater it. They don't usually need to stay too wet. Keep it in that bright spot because it's putting out some new growth. Do everything you're doing now and continue to do it until April. In April, you can plant it in the garden, and they're really hardy perennials. As Fred just said, they will grow in full sun to pretty heavy shade.
Yep.
And from dry to moist areas, they'll grow kind of almost anywhere you want them to grow, and the deer don't eat them, and they typically will bloom for us in the garden anywhere from mid-March through April. So yours will not bloom again this year because it will think it's July when you get it in April in the ground. But it will grow and establish, and it will come around next year and do a nice show in April, March and April.
It's a gorgeous perennial, too. That thing is very hardy, and like Greg said, very few problems with it. And, it really is one of those underutilized perennials, I think, in the landscape. You can't use them enough. We got a bunch of them at the Arb, and they just come back every year. But they look like they're going to be fussy or more delicate, but they're actually the opposite. They're a good-looking plant that works well, that's easy to grow.
Shelley, thanks a lot. We go now to Ballston Spa, New York, and Chris, you're on. Chris.
Hi, guys. Thanks for calling. About 10 years ago, my husband and I put in a raised bed that was 3 foot high, 4 foot wide, and 32 foot long. And it was made with 2x12 hemlock, rough hewn. But really, we're looking for something that is a permanent fixture as a raised bed. We're thinking of galvanized tubs, or perhaps my husband's ambitious, but we're in our mid-60s, so we only want to do this one more time. You take a metal fencing and you make a gap, and then you fill that with rock for the sides of the beds. So we're looking for the most permanent thing we could make a bed out of.
Well,
that doesn't
the first thing
lead
I wanna,
into the soil and hurt vegetables.
Right. The first thing I wanted to say is if you're in your mid-60s, the wood, you should be looking forward to rebuilding those hemlock beds two more times at least.
Oh.
Just so you know.
No,
how
thank
optimistic.
You. No, I don't want to do that.
All right.
A longer-lasting product.
Yes. I've seen people use those galvanized metal tubs quite well. I don't know how long they last, especially if they're sitting on the ground. The bottoms might, the where they've tacked them all together, where the seams are, may start to loosen
up. We're
going to
raise them. We would raise them.
Yeah. I think they would certainly last longer than the hemlock. I think any container that is more inert than wood is going to work out for you. I don't have any more to say about the stone one. How about you, Fred?
I'm not going to give up on the wood yet, and just because at the Arboretum here, we use a lot of larch wood for a lot of the things that are going to be buried, like literally, like posts in grounds or any kind of treads for wet areas. And I will tell you that you can get rough cut larch, at least, you know, around us, there's a lot of mills that do a lot of woodworking out in this area, and they sell the larch wood relatively cheap. And we use it for mostly all the decking and all the planks and all the trail work and all the bridges and everything that we do at Landis. And, you know, honestly, I've never seen a piece of the larch rot out yet. It is a very rot-resistant wood, and we don't treat it with anything. So it's easy to build. It's inexpensive, and it may just solve your problem for long enough that you're not going to need to worry about it. I mean, it might be the way to go. Now, that being said, if you really wanted to go stone would work. I mean, you could use interlocking stone, and you are going to, you know, have that there for the next generation.
Yeah,
but that's a lot more work, and I don't think it's necessary.
Well, Chris, good luck, and we appreciate it very much. Now we go to Andy in Delmar. Andy in Delmar.
Hi. I think the deer may have won. I have 5 arborvitae bushes that are about trees that are about 10 foot high, and 1 year I forgot to wrap them in burlap, so probably the first 4 feet, however high a deer can reach, the branches are all chewed off. The question is there any way to bring those branches back?
All right.
Yeah, the good news is they're coming back. That's the good news. If you can prevent them from being eaten again, they're going to all come back for you. So a fence around them to get them to flush back out. A couple of years, you should, you know, probably not even notice. You might have to do a little pruning to make them even. But some conifers don't do really well with regenerating on old wood. But arborvitaes are luckily for a lot of us, they regenerate really nicely. So you'll definitely get your branches back. Just got to keep the deer off them. So fencing during the fall through spring, it's almost never a problem in the summer.
Greg.
Yep. Hi, great.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, that's it. Okay, fair enough. Well, Andy, thank you very much. Hey, last question here. We only have about 45 seconds. This one is from Corey in Saratoga Springs. And Corey says, when is a good time to start broccoli seeds and tomato seeds for a vegetable garden for this year?
Tomatoes, not before April 1st. Broccoli, it depends on where you live, because you can actually be putting the broccoli starts into the garden possibly late April, certainly here in South County, the Berkshires. You can be usually putting broccoli and similar things out late April, so you could start them sooner. That said, don't worry about it so much, and the 1st of April would also be fine, and then both plants would be ready to go in by late May, which would be great for the tomatoes and just fine for the broccoli.
Fred Breglia, how do people find out more about the Landis Arboretum?
It's going to be landisarboretum.org.
Landisarboretum.org. Well, hey, man, thanks for being here. That, by the way, your second phone sounded a lot better. So
yeah, it's our normal phone. We had an issue, but they resolved it. I told them it was high pressure. They needed to get this fixed today for WAMC.
All right, man. Well, thanks a lot for being here.
All right, be well, my friend.
Yep, we'll talk to you soon. Greg Ward, how do people find out more about Ward's Nursery?
Yes, on the web, wardsnursery.com or 600 South Main Street, Great Barrington.
Well, thank you also for being here, and we'll talk to you guys soon. Support comes from Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, a plastic surgeon dedicated to cosmetic surgery and aesthetic medicine, treating the face, breasts, and body since 1996. A surgeon's hands, a woman's touch, CAPEK, plasticsurgery.com. Well, once again, thanks to Greg and Fred for being here today. Thanks to Zach Malloy for being our engineer, as he always is. Thanks to Wes for taking the calls. Our producer, Jackie Orchard, I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, well, how about this for a blast from the past? Chef Rick Orlando will join us tomorrow at 2 to share some cooking tips. He's not much of a, maybe he can bake cookies, I don't know, but he'll cook things, and we'll talk to him about it, and we'll talk some spices and whatnot. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.